Voltron fans, this is Mark Morrell, your host for Let's Voltron, the official Voltron podcast. We're excited. We're going to be doing another episode review from season 8, and I can't wait to get started. So I'll bring on my co-host, Greg Tyler. Welcome, Greg Tyler.
Hello, Mark Morrell. Hello, listeners and fellow Voltron fans. It's great to be back. I'm sorry, I was just a little late coming to the recording because I had to put a little bit of medicine on my battle scars. No, I'm just kidding. That's the episode we're going to cover, Battle Scars from Voltron Legendary Defender Season 8. It's one of the really good episodes of the season. I really like it. What do you think of the episode?
I like it because it's our main cast again, and we guess basically everybody in the main cast has a speaking part. So I appreciate that. There's very little additional voices that are in this. Mm-hmm. And it's just a good, solid episode that, you know, basically we get to see all the characteristics of all of our paladins, you know, throughout the course of the episode. It's good stuff.
And Josh Keaton is involved. He doesn't play Shiro, but he's still part of the cast playing one of the other characters, right?
Right. So it's all good. We're revisiting, you know, a planet that we had been to in previous episodes. So I'm just not excited about the ending of it.
Yeah, that's true.
It's a little sad.
It is. It is. And this is another one of those cases where you'd really like to know what happened next to the Okari because, well, we don't hear much anything from them or even about them after this episode, which is unfortunate.
And we didn't even hear about that at the end of season 8 either, did we? When all those realities came back and we also got back Dibazol and Altea, did we get back Olcarion?
They didn't mention it, but yeah, it makes you wonder. And if they didn't, why not?
I mean, indirectly, Enerva was responsible for the death of this planet because the Robeast siphons off all the quintessence.
Right. And where do you draw the line? I mean, you know, the Komar, when they were experimenting with the Komar way back when, was it season 1? When they were playing with the Komar and they wiped out that planet with the deer and all those cute animals and the beautiful plants and seemingly no sentient life. But yeah, where do you draw the line where, you know, the nastiness that the Galra have done over the millennia? I don't know. That's kind of a tough question.
Yeah. I mean, if anything, it would just be real cool to see what influence the surviving members of the Olcari had, you know, on the rest of the universe, depending on whatever location they were doing it from, but trying to reestablish their civilization and then, you know, going back to doing what they do best, you know, like the best engineers in the universe.
Yeah, it might have been fun to see, and I know we're kind of jumping the gun because we haven't even covered the episode yet, but I mean, we're talking about, you know, what goes after, which we're not going to really get to, of course, by looking at the episode itself. And imagine they could have found some of the Olcari and maybe had them on board the Atlas to help explain some of the amazing features that it wound up having later. I mean, you know, the cat was kind of out of the bag as of the end of season 7 with its ability to transform and all that. But maybe we could have got a little bit of a different rationalization for how they powered the ship than the crystal, or maybe they need additional power and the Olcari do their thing, or maybe when they do the merge later in the season with Voltron, when the Atlas merges with Voltron, maybe the Olcari could have had a hand in that in some way. I don't know. I would like to have had at least a mention of where some of them wound up. I don't know.
Yeah. So the title Battle Scars, obviously it always has double meanings, right?
Mm-hmm.
So of course, every scar has its own story, right?
Right.
So if you have a scar, there's a story behind how you got the scar, what you were doing at the time it happened, all that kind of stuff. And sometimes looking back on a scar, you know, makes you think about either the past or the future, or, you know, what could have been, you know, had you done something differently, then you might not have gotten the scar, all that kind of stuff.
Right.
But battle scars, obviously there was a battle that took place on Olcarion with that Robeast.
Right. The planet was scarred. Their civilization was scarred. I mean, they're forever impacted by what happened. There are echoes that are scarring Pidge to a point, too.
So, oh, yeah, definitely. Definitely. Pidge was very heavily affected throughout this whole episode.
Yes.
And that's why she really appreciated the understanding of the rest of her paladins near the end.
Right.
So, Let's get started.
Okay, let's do it.
Okay, so we're talking about Voltron Legendary Defenders Season 8, Episode 4, Battle Scars, written by Josh Hamilton, directed by Michael Chang. The only additional voice is Mindy Sterling, who plays Reiner.
All right. I absolutely love her voice. It has so much depth and richness, and it's always a treat. Every line she says, I keep thinking, man, that's a great voice. Seriously, back in Greening the Cube, when Reiner is teaching Pidge about bonding with nature and all that stuff, I'm like, there's just something so cool about that voice. I don't know what.
Well, towards the end of this episode, Pidge mentions something about how the Alkari have more to teach us, and Reiner certainly has that voice of a teacher.
Yeah, definitely.
So, as a result of what happens to Reiner in this episode, and we'll get back to, you know, what really did happen during the course of the episode and near the end, but I wanted to do it in memory of Reiner. I wanted to do a little salute to Mindy Sterling. We don't always get a chance to do that, and I want to go back through the career of Mindy Sterling to go over some of the stuff that she's done.
Okay.
All right, so Mindy Sterling, in addition to playing Reiner, has been in many different voiceover roles, and I can't even get into it. I mean, if you just look out on IMDb, there's literally hundreds of TV, movie, and voiceover roles.
Wow.
People who followed the creators of Voltron Legendary Defender in their previous animated series, like The Legend of Korra and Avatar The Last Airbender, we'll remember Mindy Sterling as Toph Beifong in The Legend of Korra.
Okay.
She also has been on Robot Chicken, The Wild Thornberries, The Looney Tunes Show, Justice League Unlimited, and many, 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 many more. Currently, she plays Mrs. Sneedly on The Epic Tales of Captain Underpants.
Cool.
So then if you go back through her TV career, she's been on things like That's So Raven, The Sweet Life of Zack and Cody, iCarly, Desperate Housewives, and, like I said, hundreds more. Mm-hmm. And then if you go back through her movie career, of course, she was Frau Farbissina in the Austin Powers movies.
Oh, yes! Love it.
Yeah. And then she was in How the Grinch Stole Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
And I think she was in even one of the Transformers movies.
Okay.
Yeah, I think she played an insurance agent in one of the Transformers movies.
Okay, cool.
But again, there were lots and lots of more movie roles that she's played. So Mindy Sterling has been doing this for many, many, many years, and she's a favorite of ours, and we just love her as an actress. So thank you, Mindy Sterling, for being our Reiner.
All right.
Okay. So for Battle Scars, the description that Netflix has is, while floating through the universe searching for signs of a Robeast, the Paladins head toward Alkarion and realize they aren't alone on their journey.
Hmm. Interesting description.
Yes. Because a little bit later on, they run into an old friend.
Yes. Or maybe not a friend, yeah.
Or at least somebody that Keith and Hunk knows really well.
Yes, a little too well. And Karan knows even more well.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Okay. So, as we said before, there was only one additional voice. Mindy Sterling plays Reiner. But Shiro is not in this episode, but Josh Keaton does play a character, and that is Olkari Tower Engineer 1.
Okay. All right.
Okay. So we start off, we see a planet, mostly round, with large rock formations jutting out from the top on two sides. And if you're familiar from previous episodes of Voltron Legendary Defender, you'll notice it's Alkarion.
Mm-hmm.
So we see a massive fireball entering the atmosphere.
And it looks very familiar.
We've seen this before, right?
Yes, on Earth.
Yes. In a city on Alkarion, the fireball is watched by citizens on the ground as it crashes into the city between buildings and causes a large ball of dust around the crash site. And as the dust settles, we see one of Inerva's Altaian-piloted Robeasts with two pickaxes in hand ready to battle.
Yep, it means business.
And that's where the scene ends.
Yep.
And then we go to another scene in space. The five lions are traveling together, and Hunk, half awake, stares at his screen and says, "Okay, that's the third star system we checked in the last 11 days, and we still haven't found a single clue about any Robeasts." Now, Pidge, coming into a split screen with Team Punk, Pidge has her head on her hand, and she says, "Actually, that was the 11th star system in the last 3 days." Hunk says, "Was it really? Oh my gosh. Okay, see, I'm so worn out I can't even, you know." And then the split screen moves to the left with just Lance and Hunk now. And Lance says, "Count?" And Hunk says, "No, think." So now Alora, all by herself, says, "I know this is not ideal, but the intel we received from the Galra cruiser and Lon's fleet identified one of those Robeasts within this quadrant. We must find it." Keith says, "Unfortunately, we just don't know how current that information is." And Pitch says, "Also, this celestial quadrant is 230,000 light years in diameter."
Now, as a point of reference, the diameter of our galaxy, the Milky Way, is about 100,000 light years. So this quadrant has a diameter that is over twice that of our entire galaxy.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, just like Hunk, I'm going to say what Hunk says. "I can't even process what that means." So Pidge wants to use graphical animations to explain her points. So she says, "Okay, picture five fleas searching for another flea on a dog that's the size of Earth." And they actually show a dog over the Earth.
Yes, and were the fleas color coordinated? Because, you know, what are we?
Animals?
That's what it was. Thank you.
So Hunk says, "Ugh, all this talk about fleas is making me itchy." And he scratches himself. "Are you guys feeling itchy? I thought that they could have done fleas in a more anime-like way. Don't you think?"
Yeah, I agree. I mean, with all the tropes that they use sometimes. Yeah, I would think so. I don't know. I didn't put a lot of thought into it because, you know, sometimes Hunk just sort of goes off into his own little space cal zones and all the rest of that. So I didn't really think too much about it.
Okay. So Lance, with his feet up, says, "Pidge, why can't you and Hunk just make a Robeast tracker thingy? You know, do some math and science stuff, then put some components together and bam, it's done."
Hee hee. If only.
Alora says, "Perhaps we should set our heading for the Altaian colony." Keith says, "We talked about this. To get to the colony, we'd have to travel through the quantum abyss." Pidge says, "Plus, Kolovan says the colony no longer exists." And Alora says, "But there will be clues there, something to go off of." Keith says, "Traveling through that abyss was one of the most harrowing experiences of my life. A single misstep could turn a 6-month journey into a 10-year journey. The creatures, the environment, everything in there wants you dead." And then Cosmo whines, "Except you." And he pets Cosmo.
Now, isn't that interesting that Cosmo seems in tune with what Keith is saying? It's one thing to say, you know, "Oh, who loves you, little Cosmo?" Have, you know, Cosmo respond, you know, because animals like to be, you know, loved on and all that stuff. But this seems to be a very specific thing. Maybe it's coincidence. Maybe it's not.
I really think Cosmo understands what people are saying. I mean, so many times he's done things that Keith wanted him to do, so...
Yeah, without any kind of communication. So,
yeah. Yeah, I mean, sort of like the same way that the space mice have a connection with Alora. I really think Keith, after all the time that he spent with Cosmo, you know, either whether we're talking about the quantum abyss or everywhere else since, I really think they have a connection.
Yeah, that's probably true.
So did you ever wonder?
I wonder? Why?
You were talking about dogs and how they sort of have unconditional love for us.
Yeah.
What if we were really like what they thought we were like?
What if they really thought?
No. What if humans were actually as good as dogs thought we were? That they give us such unconditional love?
Oh my. That's a philosophical question.
Yes, it is.
Wouldn't that be a, 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 a better world. If
yes, we, I mean, wouldn't it be a better world if we were actually what dogs thought of us?
Yeah, I mean, we would all get along, all people everywhere. We might sniff each other's butts just to make sure we knew who we were talking to. But other than that, we'd all get along.
Yeah.
What a world.
Yeah, I'm just thinking about it.
We now return to Voltron, Legendary Defender.
Yes. So after Keith pets Cosmo, Laura says, "I'm tired of hearing what we can't do and what we don't know." And Lance says, "Allura, we just want to make the best decisions." And Allura says, "The Altaians were my people, and the last of them are being exploited as soldiers in someone else's war. You don't understand." Lance says, "I understand what it feels like to see someone I care about hurt so much." And then Allura, lowering eyes, she sighs and says, "I'm sorry, Lance."
Yeah, I mean, this is a way to touch on the connection between Lance and Allura. And by the way, exposition, remember? This is what's going on from a few episodes ago.
And Allura's really feeling the need to try to reach the rest of the Altaians before they get even more corrupted by Enerva.
Right.
And she actually thinks there's a way to bring them back somehow.
Yeah.
Yeah, the sooner she gets in touch with her Altaian comrades, the better.
Right.
So Hunk says, "Okay, maybe we need to head to Alcarion. We're just a few galaxies away. They might have some information on any unusual sightings." Keith says, "Hunk's right. Alcarion's a great spot to regroup and reevaluate our situation." And then Pidge, smiling, says, "And it'll be awesome to see everyone again. I wonder what kind of technological advances they've made in the last few years. Oh, man, if they figured out a way to untangle the uncertainty principle," and she puts her hands together with her eyes sparkling, "new precision calculations could open the doors to a flood of innovations." She's excited.
Yes, and the uncertainty principle is a thing. It's also called the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. It's a quantum mechanics concept where you cannot precisely know both the position and the, I believe it's the momentum of anything that you observe at the quantum level. So there's a limit to how precise you can be with both measurements at the same time. There you go.
So how is that something that would be untangled?
For us, as far as we know, it just is what it is. But if humans can eventually find technology to transcend the speed of light, as we see has happened on Voltron, then maybe they'll figure out a way to get around the uncertainty principle as well. Who knows?
I mean, isn't it just like human nature that we don't know what we don't know, and things that are uncertain could remain uncertain?
Well, sure.
You can't bring certainty to everything that's uncertain, right?
Right. But the uncertainty principle is a little different beast than the idea of in our minds being uncertain about stuff. But no, I get what you're saying.
So Lance says, "I think I understood like three of those words."
Yes, I think I understood about three of those words too.
Keith says, "Allura, what do you think?" Allura says, "Perhaps a trip to Alcarion is best." And then Hunk says, "All right, let's do this." So Pidge taps on her computer screen. "Hailing Alcarion, be advised the Paladins of Voltron are en route." And there's nothing but static.
Holy crud, you were either blowing your nose or that was an amazing static impression.
Pidge says, "This is Pidge, hailing Alcarion, do you copy?" More static. Hunk says, "Are they not home?" Lance says, "Probably too busy untangling calculations. Am I using that right?" Hunk says, "No, not even close."
That is true. And so I do think it's funny now in retrospect when Hunk says, "Are they not home?" You're right, Hunk. But anyway.
So you don't untangle calculations.
No. Well, I don't know. I guess it depends on how unorganized you might be in your math notebook. But yeah.
Well, usually a calculation involves something and something.
Right.
Equal to something and something.
Yes. Yes. But I'm uncertain about that. Anyway.
Okay. So Pidge says, "I'm guessing there's a delay due to our distance. We'll probably receive their reply on the way." So Keith says, Paladins, if we want to get to Alcarion quickly, there's only one way to do it.
Oh, yeah.
And guess what?
I don't know.
They never say it, but they form Voltron.
Oh, yeah. Any excuse to form Voltron, even if it's just for one scene, it's a good reason.
Yeah, it's probably a pretty good reason. After they form Voltron, Keith says, engage wings. So Keith and Lance slam their Bayards in and turn. Then that giant jetpack appears on Voltron's back.
Yeah, I keep thinking of it as the fast pack, which is the term they give to the Macross Valkyries with all the crazy boosters on the back. So yeah, cool stuff.
Do you remember the time when they didn't even have enough energy to go anywhere, and now all of a sudden they're going across the universe in no time at all?
Yeah, I would really like to see a race between, well, I can't do it now because it's gone, but a race between the Castle of Lions wormhole propulsion and Voltron with these fancy wings. That would be an interesting race.
Yeah, that would be cool.
Yeah.
Sort of like the Flash versus Superman race.
That's right. How would that work? A racing lion and vehicle Voltron forming from the old series. Oh, yeah, we have a YouTube video about that. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. You do. You want to talk about that?
Yeah, it's a bit of an aside. But yeah, so on the YouTube channel, one of the things that a lot of people have believed, especially since the Robot Chicken episode, which is hilarious, by the way.
It is.
Yeah.
It is.
There's this Galaxy Alliance base from the 80s Voltron show that's being attacked by the Drools, and they call Voltron. Well, unlike what most of us expect, Lion Voltron showing up, the vehicle team shows up, and the gag of the episode is that they take so long to form Voltron that the base is completely destroyed. So by the time they're finally there and they finally form, they are way too late to help anybody.
It takes even longer when they don't do the steps right. And then they have to untangle themselves and then start over again.
Yeah, it's hilarious. They say something like, okay, back to step five or whatever. And they're playing Voltron-style music while these little vehicles are reconnecting and all that. So it's a hilarious sketch. But as a result, many people believe that Vehicle Voltron really did take a heck of a long time to form compared to the Lion robot. So I actually went back and made a video, which is, I called it the Defenders of the Universe Formation Races or something like that, where I took clips from some episodes and basically did a race between the Lion Force and the Vehicle Team to see who really was faster. And unless you come up with a really, really contrived set of circumstances, the Vehicle Team is much faster at forming Voltron than the Lion Force is. So check out that video on YouTube. It's kind of fun.
Okay, great. The giant jetpack appears on Voltron's back, and the thrusters engage, and Voltron shoots off into space.
Woo!
They come out of light speed to a bunch of asteroids, and Lance says, "Welcome to Alcarion's galactic neighborhood." Did we ever hear from them?
No.
Pitch says, "Actually, no," which is strange. "I'll try and contact them again." And then, whoa! We got incoming! So a red triangle appears on a green holographic screen, and an alarm beeps. Something big is headed our way at an incredible speed. What did you think it was when you first heard that?
I don't know. It's just one of those deals where I was just thinking, oh, I don't know. What is it? Let's find out. What did you think?
I actually thought it was a nervous Robeast.
Okay.
I mean, that was the logical conclusion I came to right away. Oh, wow. They didn't even have to look for it. There it is.
Yeah.
I really was not expecting what it is.
I certainly didn't expect that either.
Yeah. So Lance says, a Galra cruiser? Some kind of weapon? Allura says, is it a Robeast? See, even Allura thought it was.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Yeah, okay, all right.
Thank you, Allura, for backing me up.
That's right. Actually, I thought it was the Mega Maid from Spaceballs, but you know.
Spaceballs 1?
Yes, that's right. Spaceball 1, right.
All right, so Keith says, shield up. The shield forms in Voltron's left hand while the right hand holds the sword. In the distance, a huge fish-like creature approaches.
Yes. And so, all right, I want to point out that this, I think, is the first and only time that we see the shield form right after the wings, the crazy wings are in place. So the wings vanish and revert to their normal form and just immediately flip around and come together to make the shield. So that's kind of a neat first-time thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was pretty cool.
Yeah.
So Lance says, what the heck is that thing? Now Hunk, smiling and thrilled, says, it's a Weblum! Keith, look! We've been inside one of those. Keith, who's not thrilled, says, how could I forget? Why do you think Keith's not thrilled about the Weblum?
I think the better question is, why is Hunk thrilled that it is a Weblum?
I think it's more that from a scientific standpoint, he knows what it is over some of the members, the other paladins other than Keith, and he's familiar with it. You know, here's something in the universe I'm familiar with and you guys aren't. And that's so strange for Hunk to be in that position.
Well, that's true.
I mean, he learned a lot from being there. He was farted out of the Weblum.
Yeah, I got to get farted out of the Weblum's butt. And then I couldn't believe he was saying what he was saying in that episode. It was so funny.
So, yeah, I think that's why he's excited, because he actually recognizes this thing and he knows what a Weblum does and what it's for and everything. But I don't think he realizes the danger that they're in as a result of this.
Yeah, it's kind of like when they met Lon again and Hunk's all excited that, you know, this is his buddy. You know, they had this working relationship and maybe didn't think about how Lon might actually feel about the Paladins. And maybe this is just another example of Hunk sort of, oh, man, this was so exciting. And you know, hey, it's Hunk being Hunk.
Yeah. I mean, considering where he was at the beginning of the series to where he is now, he's a universal explorer, basically. He's been around and he's experienced a lot of things. And this is just something familiar to him in a universe that's so large.
Mm-hmm.
The Weblum's mouth opens and Pidge says, what is it doing? Hunk says, actually, it's creating Skulltrite. Now a big glow is coming from the mouth. Pidge, you would love it. It's this amazing chemical process. Lance interrupts him and says, science talk later. We're in its line of fire. Keith says, thrusters. A massive beam of light shoots from the Weblum's mouth, just missing Voltron.
Woohoo! Okay, so big question. The Weblum, it's Death Ray or whatever, or I guess you could say after Death Ray, since, you know, the way that it operates. If it's powerful enough to do what it does to planets, I wonder how, you know, sometimes you hear about people saying, ooh, I'd love to see a fight between a Star Destroyer from Star Wars and the Enterprise from Star Trek. Who would win? It makes me wonder, is a Weblum's beam more or less powerful than the six Zyforge cannons, for example? You know, Voltron got hit, had a sustained blast from six of those beams and was hit from all those different cannons around the Earth. How would it fare against a Weblum? Fortunately, we don't have to find out, but I am curious. Oh, well.
The world may never know.
Love it.
Just like how many licks it takes to get to the center of a Tootsie Pop.
Oh, we do know. One, two, three. Three. Yes.
So Lance says, should we go on the offensive? Hunk says, no. They may be dangerous, but they're essential for the universe. Think of them like giant space bees. Keith and I learned all about them from a video that Karan made. There was some rule like, if you don't want to be killed, stay away from its gills. Keith says, that wasn't the rhyme. It's, if you don't want to be dead, avoid its head.
Yeah, it's kind of like when they were all debating about what a ray gun sounds like. Remember on the Castle of Lions Bridge?
Yeah, blam, blam, and blam.
Yeah.
Yeah. Alora says, we don't have time to listen to you rhyme.
I love that.
And Hunk goes, you just... And then Keith goes, Hunk! See, this kind of reminded me of the Princess Bride.
Yes, yes.
Fezzik, are there rocks ahead? If there are, we'll all be dead.
Yep.
All right, no more rhymes. Now I mean it. Does anybody want a peanut?
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was that kind of thing.
So, did you ever watch G.I. Joe, A Real American Hero in the 1980s?
Oh, yeah, of course.
Okay, do you remember the character called Roadblock?
Oh, man.
He was an African-American Joe who had a mustache and his head was shaved, and he almost always spoke in rhymes.
Oh, okay. All right. Can you remember one?
Oh, gosh, no. I haven't watched the show in almost 30 years, but I just remember he that was his shtick. And I think he liked to cook a lot, too. That was one of his personality traits. But that's who I thought of just now. Sorry.
Okay. Not that we have a roadblock in the middle of our review.
Yeah. Yo, Joe. Now we know, and knowing is half the battle.
That's right. Okay, so Alora says, where is that Weblum going? Pidge says, according to my calculations, it's headed toward Okarion. Keith says, then we better get there first. Voltron fires up their thrusters and flies past the Weblum. As they get to Okarion, Voltron splits up into the five lions and they enter the planet's atmosphere. Now, in Green Lion, Pidge stares with wide eyes at the devastated planet. They land and leave the lions. The wind is howling. They stand together looking at a deserted planet in ruins, and Pidge lowers her head. Here comes the sad part.
Yes.
Pidge says, they were our allies, our friends. And then Keith says, Paladins, I know this is a difficult moment, but we need to get to work. That Weblum is headed here right now, so time is short. Our top priority is search and rescue. If there are survivors, we need to find them. And we need to find out what happened here. Good plan?
Yeah.
Okay. So Alora says, there's only one thing capable of this. Keith says, well, let's confirm it. So what do you think she meant?
Slav. Yeah, step on a crack, break your planet's back, you know.
Oh, no, it was not Slav. Seriously, who did you think it was?
Step on some dust, destroy your planet's crust. I mean, come on. No, honestly, I thought she was thinking it was the Altean Robeast.
Oh, okay.
Or a Komar, right. but we've not seen the Komar used since Zarkon right. was kicking, so.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I think they're all thinking that Robeast.
Yeah, I mean, it had a weapon that they said flat out was just like the Komar, so.
So they watch as Keith walks away. Using a flashlight, Lance investigates the rubble around him. The yellow lion walks through destroyed buildings and scans the environment. In what used to be the forest, Alora and Pidge pass by dead trees and bushes. Pidge actually touches a single black leaf left on a tree, and it disintegrates as soon as she touches it.
Oh, that's just... tears you up, doesn't it?
Yeah. This gets sadder and sadder.
It really, really does.
Yeah. So, in the sky above in Black Lion, Keith is flying over a massive crater in the ground. And Keith says, I think our worst fears have been realized. Hunk says, what do you see? Keith says, the physical wreckage and destruction patterns are just like those on Earth. Laura says, our findings are the same. It appears the quintessence was siphoned out of Okarion as well. Hunk says, Lance and I took readings. We picked up trace elements of cypherite. That's the same metal the creature on Earth was made from. So did we ever get told it was cypherite, or was that just something that just came up now for the first time?
Just for the first time. I'm just assuming that when they spent those months taking all the wreckage of the first Robeast out of the ocean or lake or whatever it was on Earth, at the end of the seventh season, you know, they said, oh, it's been months. We've looked at it. And then they find the Altean inside. I'm assuming that they did some kind of metallurgical analysis or something and figured out off screen that it was made from cypherite.
So isn't the armor that the Robeasts are made from coming from melted down statues from Orion?
That, well, I mean, we see those things getting melted. We don't know if that's all that they melted, but certainly that was among the stuff. So, yeah, we may have known of that material from there, but it certainly wasn't identified that way on screen. And the only people we know who went there were Alora and Lotor, and they didn't seem to be doing a lot of study of that material while they were there. They were trying to, you know, learn more about alchemy and all that stuff. So maybe they already knew about that material going into that place. Maybe not. Hard to say.
Okay. So Laura says, why did this Robeast attack Okarion of all places? Lance says, maybe because it was a central part of the coalition? Laura says, maybe. I just get the feeling there's something more to it. Keith says, you might be right, but we don't have any way to confirm it. Right now, we just need to focus on finding survivors. Now, Alora, still in the forest, says, Pidge, have you picked up anything? Pidge is looking around and doesn't seem to have heard Alora. Alora says, Pidge, do you copy? So, no answer. Allura jetpacks over to Pidge and walks in front of Pidge, and Allura says, "Pidge." Pidge says, "I know this place. This is where Reiner taught me how to bond with the forest. The Okari people helped me to make that connection. I learned more from them than I ever thought possible." Pidge lowers her head, and Allura puts her hand on Pidge's shoulder. Pidge says, "Allura, they had so much more to teach the universe," and tears fall down her face. "And now they're gone." Pidge falls to her knees crying. That's tough, man.
It is. Really, really tough. Yeah, you don't, I mean, I don't think, have we seen Pidge get this emotional since the episode reunion when she thought that Matt had died?
No.
Yeah.
No, we saw her get angry when Zarkon was holding her dad.
Right.
But we never saw her get this emotional and sad since she thought her brother died.
Yep.
So Alcarion and everything that happened to her when she made that connection with Green Lion meant a lot to her.
Yep.
So all of a sudden, Pidge hears girls' laughter echoing. She looks up and says, "Huh?" And then Pidge raises her head. Two Alcari children play with a ball, and the laughter continues. Allura says, "Pidge," kneels down beside her. "Are you all right?" Pidge says, "You didn't see it?" Allura says, "See what?" Pidge says, "The forest. It was back to how it was before. There were girls playing." Allura says, "Maybe this place is trying to show you something." And Pidge says, "What?" Allura says, "The Okari had a profound connection to the land, just like you do. Their history could be etched into the very soil for you to see. Concentrate. See if you can tap into its energy."
Yeah, isn't it nice? And I mean this, and I sincerely mean this. It's great that Allura is the person who's with Pidge right here and right now. If anyone else had been here, I don't know that she would have gotten this encouragement, because I don't think anyone else would have felt in touch with anything on such a magical or cosmic level that they could have even suggested this.
Yeah, if she would have split up with Fred or Shaggy, I don't think this would have ever happened.
Or, for that matter, you know, the boring ones, Hunk, and Lance, and Keith. And, yeah, right. Or Cosmo.
Yeah, I really think, yeah, Allura, with her knowledge that she got at Oriond, with being able to connect with the Balmera and all those other things, I think, yeah, definitely Allura's the best one to have with her at this point.
I almost wonder, and I don't mean this, I mean, obviously the writers contrived it this way, but you could maybe read between the lines and infer that maybe Allura had some intuition that because Pidge had bonded with the Okari and learned to bond with nature, maybe she felt like she needed to be the one with Pidge at this point.
Maybe.
Yeah.
So Pidge stands and closes her eyes, and the forest transforms to its former blooming state. "The girls are playing. Come on, follow me," says one of them. The two girls run past Pidge. Then Pidge sees the fireball shoot past this in the sky. Pidge says, "Huh?" It heads away from her, and Pidge gasps. Pidge says, "We need to get to the city." So it looks like she knows at least where she needs to be to see the next vision.
Mm-hmm.
So in the city, Allura and Pidge use their jetpacks to fly to the top of a building so they can look over the Robeast's crash site.
Mm-hmm.
Pidge stares at the giant crater in the ground. The devastated city transforms to its original look. The Okari watch in horror as the Robeast lands before them. The impact booms and Pidge shouts. Pidge gasps after the dust clears and she sees the Okari shouting, and then she sees a familiar face. Pidge says, "Reiner!" Allura says, "You can see Reiner? What is she doing?" Pidge watches the Robeast rise to its feet, holding two pickaxes. Pidge says, "The Robeast! It's here!" So the Robeast raises its pickaxes over its head, then slams them down into the ground, causing an enormous wave of destruction. Pidge says to Allura, "We need to get closer." So using their jetpacks, they fly over to the Robeast crash site. The Robeast towers over Pidge, who turns to see Reiner standing before a small group of Okari. Pidge says, "Reiner!" Reiner, talking to the other Okari, says, "Get civilians to evacuation pods and launch them immediately. Have all military personnel report to battle stations. Scramble the mechs for counterattack. Pidge drops in near Reiner in between the two Ulkari that are left. Reiner turns and looks directly at Pidge. Reiner says, come with me. Do you think she looked directly at Pidge or the other two?
It seems to me that she's just talking to the other two. It could be by sheer coincidence that, you know, obviously it is. If you have that interpretation, then Pidge being right there is a happenstance. But, I mean, it's possible. I don't know if this is a perfect retelling of what's going on or if there's some essence of Reiner still here that is sort of reaching out in some kind of a psychic way. I don't know. What do you think?
All right. Well, here's the idea. I don't know that Reiner in the original time frame would have had the foresight to think if Pidge ever comes here, she's going to know what happened by, you know, reconnecting with the planet.
Right.
I don't know if she would have had that foresight.
I don't think that's true. So if there is a semblance of Reiner looking at Pidge and it is not sheer coincidence, it would not be a matter of foresight, but rather this is not necessarily a literal record of what happened, but sort of a record of what happened as seen through the lens of nature on this planet to sort of frame what's going on in a more emotional way for Pidge. That's the only way I can see that this would really be interactive in any way.
Yeah.
And that's a stretch.
It would have been like Ebenezer Scrooge being able to talk to the people when he was going back with the ghost from Christmas Past or something like that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That would have been weird.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Not the fact that he was able to go back in time with ghosts, but that would have been weird.
Right. Yes. So it's different degrees of weird. It's all relative.
Right. So Pidge, transformed back to Allura next to her, says, Reiner, it seemed like she was talking to me. Or it could have been to the soldiers. I don't know. Allura says, all the answers we're looking for could be here. We may be able to find out where this beast came from and where it's going next. There might be some clue here about the Altaians. Pitch says, if there is, I will find it. Hunk comes over the comm and says, guys, we have a major problem here. Lance says, Hunk released some low-orbit trackers outside of Ulkorion on the way in. The Weblum just set them off. We have about 10 minutes to evac.
That's not a lot of time, unless you're in a line.
Well, I'm sure Hunk kind of figured out what good amount of time is to escape from the planet, knowing the, you know, the capabilities of the lions and everything, but if you're more than 10-minute walk away from, or a jetpack away from your lion, then you're in big trouble.
Yeah, and of course you really never are now because they can summon them at any point, and that's exactly what happens. Spoilers later to some of these paladins, you know, the lions come to them.
Yeah. So Keith says, "Copy that. Everyone to their lions. Let's go now." Allura says, "We can't leave yet. How long do you think you can hold it off?" Wouldn't you have had Lance's response to this? I think we all would have had Lance's response to this.
Mm-hmm.
Hold it off? It's a giant space worm. We can't hold it off. What are you talking about? Just let me get in front of that thing and stop it for a second.
Yeah. Now, in their defense, only Keith and Hunk have ever seen this thing before, and Voltron has taken on some really powerful opponents before. So I can kind of imagine someone thinking, yeah, we'll just hold off this thing. You know, it's not like any of them, except maybe Pidge, would have done some kind of a detailed scan to see just how impossible it would be. So, yeah, it's not totally out of left field in the Voltron world. But, yeah, I think I just said the same thing Lance did.
Yeah. So Allura says, Pidge found a way to tap into Ulkarion's history. She may be able to find out what we need to know, but we need a little more time. Keith says, all right, we'll buy you as much time as we can. Allura says, copy that. Thank you. Keith says, Hunk, Lance, we need to hurry. So Keith, Hunk, and Lance fly out to meet the Weblum. Keith says, I got it on scanners. Let's intercept it. Now, on the ground, with her eyes closed, Pidge sits cross-legged. A flash of light. Then Pidge opens her eyes. Okarian ships fly through the sky. A laser shoots at the Robeast from the ion cannon atop the tower. The Robeast spins a staff around in circles like a baton and shields itself from the laser. The laser ricochets off the Robeast shield. Then the Robeast fires a laser cannon at the ion cannon, destroying it.
Yeah, that's quite a thing when you've seen what that ion cannon can do in prior episodes. That's a heck of a thing to see.
And we saw them building it.
Yeah.
So that was a shame that it kind of got knocked out in one punch, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Now, wearing mechanical cyber suits, the Alcari are running toward the Robeast. Reiner says, "Go, go, go!" Now, Pidge gasps. Reiner says, "We need to preserve the information from the communications tower. Keep the beast at bay as long as you can." Using her jetpack, Pidge flies away, and Allura follows her. Now, does Allura need to be there at this point?
Physically, no, but I think that as immersed as Pidge is in figuring out what's going on and having this connection, I think it's important for Allura to be there to help her realize when she needs to stop. I mean, there is a point at which she's going to have to stop to get off this planet alive, and I think Allura being there for that reason makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I just thought Allura could have gone off with the others a little bit earlier and maybe helped out holding back the Weblum.
Yeah, that's true. But, you know, it's not like anybody called and said, "Yeah, we need you yesterday," so who knows?
Yeah. So, in space, Keith, Hunk, and Lance approach the Weblum. Keith says, "We need to get it to divert its course." Lance says, "And how do we do that?" Hunk says, "How about like this?" And he slams Yellow Lion into the side of the Weblum. And then Yellow Lion gains those additional thrusters, which fire.
Yeah.
But then Hunk, whimpering, says, "My idea isn't working." And then Yellow Lion flies away. And then a massive beam of light shoots from the Weblum's mouth. Lance says, okay, well, what were the rules with this thing? Hunk says, "I'm drawing a blank. I'm not good under pressure." An enormous laser materializes on the Red Lion's back. The Red Lion fires the laser on the Weblum, hitting it multiple times in the back. Keith says, "It's still heading for Alcarion. We haven't slowed it down at all." So they haven't done anything. Has the 10 minutes gone by yet?
I haven't been studying the clock, but but you know, sometimes script time and real time aren't the same thing.
I'm trying to figure out how many ticks it's been.
Yeah, it's always funny in TV shows and movies, and there have been a lot of movies and shows that make fun of this, where, you know, there's this bomb, and they've got to disarm it, and at the very last second they do, but in the meantime, you see this countdown, and it might be 10 seconds on the clock, and it really takes, you know, 45 seconds of editing time before they finally disable the clock. You just have to kind of go with it, and so I don't know how long it really took.
It's sort of like when the New England Patriots are at a home game and their play clock is counting down from 25 down to 1, but when it gets to 10, somehow it goes back up to 30.
Even I can get that joke.
Yeah. So on Alcarion, Allura follows Pidge to the top of a tower. A flash of light. Then Pidge is inside the control room of the tower, and what Pidge watches is two Alcari engineers tap the screen on a control panel. We're talking, there's two engineers here, so I named them Tower Engineer 1 and Tower Engineer 2.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? We know mm-hmm. that Tower Engineer 1 is played by Josh Keaton.
Yes.
We don't know Engineer 2, because Engineer 2 only has one line, and it's very quick, and it could be anybody right. on the cast.
Yeah, and a lot of times when we're figuring out who's playing who, it's by ear. I mean, as you know, in these end credits, it just says cast and additional voices, and they're not linked up in the actual credits. So we kind of have to reverse engineer it by ear. And yeah, you and I both listened to this character's one line, as well as the lines that a little girl says later in the episode. And it's a little tough to try to figure out who's speaking either role.
Right. So Tower Engineer 1 says, "How did we not pick this thing up on our scanners?" Tower Engineer 2 says, "It just appeared." Now Pidge says to herself, just like on Earth. Tower Engineer 1 says, how could that be? Wait, bring up our scanner logs. Those anomalies we detected recently. It comes up on the screen. The Tower Engineer 1 looks at it and says, I can't believe I didn't see it before. The anomalies are from the warping of space-time. Now the engineers grunt as the Robeast hits the ground again with the pickaxes. Tower Engineer 1 says, this creature came through a wormhole. Reiner appears on the holographic screen and says, transfer all data from this facility to a safe location off-planet, then evacuate immediately.
So I got to tell you, when I first watched this episode, and again in rewatching it, I kept thinking, where is that safe location? Is it where the Okari themselves went? Is it somewhere entirely different? Is it accessible at all? I mean, obviously, Pidge is learning this stuff now through this means, so they don't technically need to find that data necessarily. But I was thinking, you know, how far away is it? Is it safe from the Weblum? Who knows?
So this is all part of a organized disaster recovery plan.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a company that has a data center somewhere and you don't want to lose all of your data, you have an equal far-off disaster recovery site where you have everything copied.
Yep, a warm or a hot site so you can, yeah, cut over pretty quickly and not lose any operating time. Yep.
So you would think that engineers like the Alkari would already have the location off-planet of where that would be.
Yes, and hopefully they equally thoroughly planned their escape as they escape this planet. So wherever they are, if it's at the same place as that data center or not, hopefully they're all safe and sound.
Right. So Tower Engineer 1 says, understood. What we just discovered could save billions of lives. The engineer quickly taps on the control panel as the Robeast's laser powers up. They send it as the Robeast's laser takes out their tower, and the engineer's shouting fades away.
They're dead, Jim.
Yeah, and Pidge falls to the ground. Allura gets beside her. Pidge says, it was a wormhole. That's how they travel. Punk says, Pidge, Allura, I'm sorry, but you got to get out of there immediately. Pidge says, I need more time. Allura says, I'm coming up to help. Allura jumps in Blue Lion and heads out to space. So I was thinking, as soon as Pidge said, I need more time, sort of like Return of the Jedi, when Han and his group were trying to shut down the shield generator for the Death Star on Endor.
We just, Han will do it. We just got to give him more time. Yeah, there we go.
Yeah. I know Han can do it. We just got to give him more time.
Yes. Now, okay, so I got to ask. In Solo, A Star Wars Story, I forget the actor's name, something Glover, who played younger Lando.
It's Daniel Glover, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. But did he call him Han in that movie or Han? I wonder.
I thought in the beginning, the first time they met, or somewhere around there, he got it wrong on purpose, I think.
Okay.
Pronounced it wrong.
Yeah, I've only seen it once or twice and don't remember that detail. But anyway.
Right.
Because everybody else calls him Han.
I've only seen that movie twice.
Yeah.
All right. So, in space, Keith fires lasers at the Weblum. The Weblum opens its mouth and shoots out a massive beam of light. The Yellow Lion swerves to avoid the beam. Lance says, over here, this way. Then the beam fires again and just misses Lance. And he says, whoa, 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 too close. How did you guys beat this thing the first time? Keith says, we never beat it. Trying to alter its course is an entirely different thing than collecting its Skulltrite. So this is an entirely different thing altogether.
Mm-hmm.
Like from Airplane.
Right.
This is an entirely different kind of flying altogether.
Yes, yes. Love it.
Okay. So Hunk says, all right, that's it. I'm calling Karan.
Oh, Karan.
Karan, come in.
I miss Goofy Karan. I'm glad he's back here.
Yes, yeah, so this is all bringing up memories of Belly of the Weblum.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So Karan comes on screen and says, Hunk, hello there. Hunk says, Karan, you're there. Okay, I'm sorry to make this quick, but we need to stop a Weblum from eating a planet, like right now. Any chance you know how to do that? Karan says, well, it's definitely been a while, but in my younger days, me and my cohorts would have a little Weblum fun. Hunk says, Karan, we're kind of in a rush here. Karan says, right, let's see. If I remember correctly, all you need to do, static hissing, on the Trilo Mutarth, which you'll find under its dorsal, more static. Hunk says, oh no, 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 not this again. Our connection is breaking up. Karan says, resulting in face boils, a runny nose, and a cosmic light radiation poisoning. And if you don't do this, you'll expand to twice your size and pop like a ball vax. Karan is stretching his face on the screen. The communication closes. Hunk says, okay, that conversation took a lot longer than I expected, and I learned nothing.
Kind of like the video.
Yeah, exactly. So they get no help from Karan in either of those times.
No, but I'm glad we had Karan here. You know, it's season 8 because there's so much going on. You know, we have legitimate complaints from some fans that, you know, there's not enough Shiro and Keith time and various other interactions that people liked so much from previous seasons. I miss the Karan moments, and it's really nice to have this here. He's not just sitting at the helm on the Atlas. He's being Karan, and that's kind of nice.
Yes. He doesn't have the slipperies, but that's okay.
I'm glad. That was not one of my favorite moments of his, but yeah.
All right. So an alarm bleeps, the Weblum's mouth opens, the blue lion appears and fires the sonar rings at the Weblum, and its mouth closes. How did she do that?
What, project a sound emanation in space?
No, I mean, we've already talked about that before.
Yes, we have.
I'm saying, what did it do that made the Weblum close its mouth?
I don't know. What do you think?
We haven't had a situation here where the Weblum ever opened its mouth and the glow came and there was no fire. This is the first time ever.
Well, it's probably thinking, well, shoot, sound in space? Well, shut my mouth.
Oh, man. Well, as long as we're doing the rhyming thing, song, song of the South, sweet potato pie, and a shut my mouth.
Oh, my goodness. Wow.
Okay. So Hunk says, Allura, thank you. But the Weblum's mouth opens again. And Allura says, please hurry, Pidge.
Eventually the laws of physics will catch up with the blue lion. That's right.
On Alcarion, Pidge watches as Reiner waves her hands, directing Alcari to board a ship. Reiner says, hurry, everyone on board. It came for something. Find out what. So the Robeast approaches them. Okari's soldiers fire at it. The Robeast breaks its staff into two pickaxes, then slams one of them into the ground before the soldiers. Its face lights up, and a massive laser shoots out of its face at the soldiers. As the dust settles, the Robeast leaps through the air. It digs into the ground. Pidge watches as it flies away with four large black cubes.
So the Okari, who are in touch with nature, have a giant landfill.
Yeah.
I just think it's funny. I mean, you know, they're in touch with nature and, you know, and all that good stuff, and they still bury their trash.
But it's not trash.
Well, yeah.
They're protecting them.
I guess.
Maybe it was locked in a safe or something.
Yeah, that's true. Maybe. And I should point out that one of my nits that I picked in greening the cube is that Voltron used its sword to slice a single giant flying cube into four equal parts, each of which was a cube. And so now I guess we see why slicing a cube in fourths to make cubes is something that they did, because apparently four of them is a perfect number, even though slicing a cube into four equal parts does not make four cubes. But that's okay.
That is nitpicking.
Yes, it is. Thank you. Thank you very much. So Phil Ferrand, this little tip of the hat to Phil Ferrand, a guy who wrote back in the 1990s several books which were really entertaining called Nitpicker's Guides. And he wrote several of them about various Star Trek shows. He wrote some about the X-Files. And I don't remember how much further he got in his book writing, but I owe some of my nitpicking to him because I love those books. So Phil Ferrand, if you're out there, great job you did back then. Write more, please. There we go.
So are we going to nitpick about Voltron Force, about how when Green Line became the center, that Green was so small that it couldn't possibly be the center of Voltron?
Oh, that's in my queue of Lions and Pilots and Bots.com articles to write, Mark. It's like you're reading my mind.
Oh, that's funny. Okay. Pidge says, it came for the cubes. Why? She looks at Reiner. Reiner, can you hear me? Do you know why the Beast wanted the cubes? Please, talk to me. Reiner just says, hurry, everyone on. Pitch says, Reiner, please, Reiner! The Robies flies out into space. An Alkari child approaches Reiner. She's sobbing. The child says, I'm scared. I don't want to leave. Reiner kneels in front of the child. Reiner says, you mustn't cling too tightly to the past. The Alkari have always been able to adapt and move forward. It is our greatest strength, and it will live on in you. The child, still sobbing, says, but our home. Reiner says, the old must give way to the new. It is the way of the universe. Now please, go. The child hugs Reiner, then boards the transport. Reiner watches as the doors slowly close and the ship flies away towards space. Now the sky darkens and Pidge looks down at her wrist, and Allura says, Pidge, Pidge, are you there? We can't hold this thing off any longer. You need to get out of there. So what do you think happened to Reiner?
She's probably dead.
I mean, that's what we're assuming here, that she sacrificed herself for everybody else, right?
Yeah, I mean, it is a fair conclusion. I mean, granted, I don't think we saw the final moments of what happened before the Robies left. I mean, maybe there was more death and destruction, but the cubes were being taken away, so maybe the Robies decided it was done. And it's possible that Reiner escaped in her own ship.
Yeah.
But we'll never know.
Yeah, I'm just wondering if the Robeast had already left, but the Quintessence had already been siphoned from the planet. The planet was basically no good.
Yeah.
Would she have had another vehicle to leave in, or what else would she have done?
I don't know.
What was her true purpose for staying there? Was it for Pidge?
Maybe it was for Pidge. That's a great question. And the words that she said to that little girl, that their spirit of, you know, adapting and moving on with their greatest strength will live on in her, it sure seemed like she was sort of sending her goodbyes and well wishes to her people as if she was accepting her fate. But maybe she did die. Maybe she did stay there for Pidge, or maybe she was there long enough that her consciousness was sort of absorbed by the planet so that this tale could be retold. So maybe even if she's not there, maybe there was enough of an echo for Pidge to tune into. I don't know.
Yeah, we may never know.
Yeah, the world may never know.
Yeah. So in space, the Weblum opens its mouth again. The Lions fire their lasers at it. The Weblum shoots its massive laser beam and Yellow Lion swerves to avoid it. Hunk says, there she is. The planet is clear. Keith says, everyone fall back away from the Weblum. So the Lions fall back. The Weblum opens its mouth and fires the beam at Alkarion. The planet cracks, glows red, and turns charcoal black. The Weblum starts eating large broken off pieces of the planet.
Yeah, so about that shot, you know, the planet flares up, it goes dark, and the large chunks of the planet very, very slowly drift away from one another. It is so dramatic. You wouldn't think blowing up a planet that odd looking would be that emotional, but they really played it for all they could.
Yeah, they did.
Yeah, the animators and all that. And my goodness. I mean, if it had been one of those Death Star style blasts where, you know, the super laser hits and boom, it's a big fireball, nowhere near the effect that it had here.
Right. Now, one thing I did want to mention, you were mentioning this before. The reason that Pidge was able to get off the planet so quickly was because Green Lion came for her.
Mm-hmm.
So she was able to just jump right in Green Lion and get out of Dodge.
Yeah, and I think Blue Lion did the same thing for Allura earlier. I think, but I could be mistaken.
Okay. It could have just been the blue lion was right there.
Yeah. But with all the jetpacking and jumping around, unless the lion was just faithfully following her. yeah, who knows? Hard to say.
It's like when they were on the Castle of Lions and we didn't get to see them do the zip line thing every time. And suddenly they were in their lines taking off.
Yeah, I mean, it did help move the plot along, but doggone it, I missed the stock footage. And the same at Voltron Force, you know, how many times did they really ever show them doing all that? And is it necessary? No. But I remember as a kid with Defender of the Universe, and not doing a retro segment here yet, but in watching that show, there was excitement, there was buildup. You know, you knew they were going to go to the Lions, and even though they did it the same way, every single time, or Prince Adam transforms into He-Man the same way every single time, or Adora Toshiro.
It's stock footage.
It is stock footage, but it was exciting. I never, as a viewer, as a kid, I never thought, oh crap, here's 30 to 60 seconds of reused footage. I always thought, all right, there go the lions, you know?
I mean, we should really enjoy the fact that in Voltron Legendary Defender, we had many different ways that Voltron formed. And the theme itself was changed up several times. So I want to thank Brad Breek and Brian Parkhurst for doing multiple versions of the Voltron transformation sequence.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I agree with you musically, and I agree with you from an editing perspective, but the shots were all the same. I mean, you know, the backgrounds differed from time to time, but I mean, it was just a different sequencing of the same stock pieces, right? I mean, you know, you got the same stock of the, you see the Green Lion's front legs fold up and rear legs, and then it and Red Lion are shooting around like rockets. And then, you know, I mean, they got the same fly around of blue and yellow where the front legs start to fold and you never see what happens to them at the end because they're off screen. I mean, it's
are you
the same
saying
stock.
It should look different? If they're on a planet in the middle of the day, the background should be look like the middle of the day on a planet instead of like out in space somewhere?
I am just saying that the footage of the formation sequences was the same as I've observed it in every single episode when they form Voltron. Now, each shot might be of a slightly different length, or you might not see the Green Lion after it connects to the Black Lion, you know, see the arm reach out and roar. They might leave out little bits and pieces here and there, but the individual shots were the same with the swirly backgrounds and all that stuff. I mean, it looks great, but it's not it's the same shots. It's similar to prior shows where the editing can change from time to time, but it's the same stuff.
Right.
Yeah. And I'm not complaining. that's just an observation.
Yeah.
But yeah. And I'm just saying that as a kid watching Defender of the Universe, you know, that never bothered me. It doesn't bother me as an adult seeing it in Legendary Defender, but seeing the characters going to the Lions or the vehicle team with all those crazy moving chairs zipping around in the Stellar Ship Explorer and all the crazy launch ramps and everything. I loved that stuff, even though it was repetitive. I was like, yeah, there goes the Voltron Force, you know? So that's all.
Okay, so we're going to go back to the Weblum eating the planet?
Yes, the Weblum is eating the planet.
Yes. Well, with wide eyes, Lance stares at the planet, and then Lance sees it being eaten by the Weblum, and he says, it's all gone. Allura says, I'm sorry, Pidge. Keith says, I wish we could have done more. Pidge says, thanks, everyone. Hunk says, if you think about it, this isn't really the end of Alcarion. Weblum's eating dead planets is just the first step in a process that leads to the growth of new stars, planets, and galaxies. Pidge smiles. Pidge says, the old gives way to the new. And then Pidge on Allura's screen says, we need to contact the Atlas. Allura says, why? Pidge says, because it turns out the Alkari weren't done teaching us a few things. They showed me a way to track the Robeasts. Their information is going to save billions of lives. And that's the end.
And what an episode.
So did you think this was one of the better episodes from season 8?
Yeah. What about you?
Yeah, I mean, it was a classic Voltron episode. So yeah, I really thought it was. It had, you know, references back to previous episodes, obviously. We had characters that we had already seen before. We had you know, going back to Greening the Cube. We had going back to Belly of the Weblum. I mean, just a bunch of things that we had seen before. And of course, references to some of those things, like the video that Curran had done for Keith and Hunk and trying to figure out how to obtain the Skulltrite. And then the same thing happened here on trying to stop the Weblum.
Right.
So I like all those things. I thought the characters were right on. I mean, everybody behaved the way those characters behave.
Yeah, I agree. I think this is a great episode. And my one outstanding question, aside from, you know, obviously, where the heck did the Okari go and, you know, what happened to them, is did King Lubos make it off of Okarion? You remember him? By Lubos.
Yeah. Do you think he was in prison or something? Do you think?
He probably was, or maybe in some a jail cell made out of, you know, made from a tangling of tree limbs or something. I don't know. But yeah, I'd think that they would have evacuated him too.
Yeah, I'm just wondering, did they exile him or did they imprison him for what he had done? I don't know.
Yeah, I'm not entirely sure, but I am mildly curious. But, you know, in asking, did I like this episode? I still stand by my statement about season 8 in terms of the individual episodes. I still really like all of the first 8 episodes, and this is one of those. And I really think that the first 8, as standalone episodes in particular, are as good as better episodes of the previous seasons. I mean, there are issues with the potentially issues, arguably issues with the continuity and wrapping up the story throughout season 8. But as individual episodes, I liked all of the first 8 a lot. And this one is no exception.
Yeah, despite the fact that Okarion was sacrificed in this one, and obviously there were a lot of Okari lives that were lost.
Mm-hmm.
They did find out how to track these Robeasts, and this is what eventually leads them to Orion.
Right.
So they're able to confront, you know, the witch at the door.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a really important thing for them to learn from all this.
Absolutely.
And it sort of changes Shiro's mind later on too, because remember, Shiro was against them going after Enerva right away.
Yeah, he says, yeah, let's go around and help out people in need and all that stuff. And yeah, he has a bit of a tidal shift there.
Yeah. So we'll see that change coming soon.
Yep. And it's, again, just so powerful. And Bex Taylor-Klaus as Pidge does such a wonderful job with these very emotional episodes. This one and Reunion, and of course, her turmoil at not finding her family and her ongoing search and her anger as Zarkon threatens her father. Yeah, the episode where ultimately Lotor kills Zarkon. A lot of powerful stuff. And Bex shows her amazing range in this episode, and she really shines.
Every single time they go from Pidge being really excited about seeing the Okari again and what technological advances they've come up with over the last few years, and then right away, the planet is in ruins.
Yeah.
I mean, and she has to deal with that. I mean, it's just one high emotion to another negative emotion. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's all over the place. And I don't mean that in a negative sense. I mean, she is legitimately reacting in completely understandable and valid ways. I'm not saying she's all over the place and, you know, makes no sense. it is justified by the events of the story. And my hat's off once again to Bex for her amazing role, her portrayal here.
Yeah, I agree. And then, of course, Josh Keaton as Okari engineer, tower operator number one, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it's a very different character. It's a much smaller, you know, less significant character than Shiro is over the course of the seasons, of course, but I did not place that character as Josh at first. And kudos to you for figuring that out. But yeah, he does a fine job there.
Yeah. I mean, Josh has a pretty good range too.
Yeah. And I'll tell you, still watching the Curran Shiro and listening to his voice and how subtly different it is than the original Shiro. And honestly, I wasn't fully aware or appreciative of how subtly different that performance was until I remember Josh responding to a question about whether or not that was deliberate. And I believe it was on this very podcast in another episode when he said, yes, that none of his choices there were accidental, and really, really gaining a new appreciation for what he brings to his roles.
And once again, thank you to Mindy Sterling for being our Reiner.
Yes. Gosh, I love that voice.
So definitely in memory of Reiner.
Yep.
Okay. You have a Retro Voltron segment, don't you?
Yes, I do. We don't always have them for time reasons and other things, but we definitely have one now. You want to get started?
Sure. Let's do it.
We now return to Retro Voltron.
I try to pick out retro elements that tie to a Legendary Defender episode that we're reviewing. And so I found a couple somewhat similar old school references to what we see in Battle Scars from Voltron Legendary Defender. And the first is probably the most obvious parallel if you're a longtime fan. And it's the Lion Force episode from Voltron Defender of the Universe called Pidge's Home Planet. And we've mentioned this plot point in some recent podcasts, but it is very relevant here. And this is an episode where the Voltron Force learns that Pidge's home planet of Balto has been devastated from an attack from Lotor. And they go, the entire Voltron Force, Allura catches up. She doesn't go initially, but they go to Balto and they see that it's been devastated. And unfortunately, Lotor is still there. Before Lotor shows up again, Pidge is walking around on the surface of Balto. And he, remember, Pidge is a he and Defender of the Universe. He's devastated by the loss of his homeworld. He'll never see his backyard again. Fortunately, you know, in Defender of the Universe, they tend to sort of distill the death count by saying, fortunately, everyone escaped, but Pidge doesn't know where they're at. And so he's in turmoil, and it's very emotional for Pidge. So they're walking around on a wrecked, dead world, and Pidge, as in the Legendary Defender episode, is torn up about it. By the end of that episode, Lotor's attack further destabilizes Balto, and it is completely destroyed. In that sense that they're on a dead planet that has a connection with Pidge and the planet goes kaplooey, that episode is very similar in many ways to Battle Scars from Voltron Legendary Defender. I should point out that in Beast King Go Lion, that same episode was called Goodbye Earth. And the planet in that episode was not Balto, Pidge's homeworld. It was Earth. Earth, in the very first episode of Go Lion, had been devastated by World War III. And the Golion team goes back to that planet and surveys what's left of Earth. And during that time, Sinclair, the Lotor character, attacks them. And during the battle, Earth is completely vaporized. It's a very different tone, and everyone is very heavily impacted by the loss of Earth. In Voltron, they made it Balto because Earth in the Voltron world is still very much alive. And they focused on Pidge's character and changed the name of the planet to give it some emotional depth for Pidge.
That was pretty amazing that they were able to focus mainly on Pidge and make it look like it was all about Pidge, when really, in reality, it was Earth that got destroyed, and all of them were devastated heavily by it.
Oh, yeah.
So how they were able to edit that together in a way that made it look like really it was all about Pidge, that was just amazing.
It was. And you know, looking back and watching Voltron, yes, it has its cheesy moments and everybody loves the joke about Lotor. Oh, should we torture them or eat cake? Oh, we'll torture them by eating cake in front of them. Everybody quotes that line, but that's not typical Lotor and Defender of the Universe. That's one of the more outlandish examples, the sillier examples of how he acts. This is a really skillfully edited adaptation. I totally agree with you.
But you said you had two examples.
I did. And I just want to say very quickly that Neil Ross, who portrays both Keith and Pidge and a variety of other guest characters and all that, he really pulls out all the stops with Pidge. And so everybody jokes about Pidge having that helium voice when he talks. But for a character with that voice, I think Neil Ross really brings it home with the emotion and sells Pidge's devastation in this episode. So hats off to Neil Ross. And again, if you go back to our Let's Voltron 5 episodes, we had a recent interview with Neil Ross. So check that out.
Did you say helium voice?
Well, kind of a helium voice, right? I mean, not that exaggerated, but, you know, a lot of people joke about Pidge having that crazy, you know, high-pitched voice, you know?
I don't know if you catch TV very often, but there's a current commercial on TV that it's all about the insurance agent for the car insurance.
Okay.
And I forget which insurance company it is, but they're in like a tunnel.
Okay.
And there was a fender bender, and it involved a helium truck.
I've not seen this.
And while they're in the car still, he's calling his insurance agent, and she says he's covered and everything's fine. And then he gets out of the car while he still has her on the phone, and he all of a sudden starts talking in a high voice, and he goes from fender bender to fender bender.
That's awesome.
Fender bender. Yeah. And then the police that come over start talking in high voices, and it gets even more funny.
I got to check that out. That's cool.
Yeah.
So hats off again to Neil Ross. And I love each and every major character portrayal that the cast of that show pulled off. And this is definitely one of the better Defender of the Universe episodes. So, yeah, you're right. I did mention there are two episodes that came to mind. And that first one was the more obvious parallel. The second one is not a direct parallel, but it was just something that came to mind when I thought of the Battle Scars episode of Voltron Legendary Defender. And that's a vehicle team episode of Voltron Defender of the Universe. And the title is Great Stone Space Faces. And yes, it's a silly title. I'm going to defend the title here. Not defend the title, but defend the fact that you never saw these titles in the actual episodes, right?
All right. Can I say what my alternate title is?
Yeah, go for it.
Great Stone Space Feces?
Yeah, I think I texted you the other day as you know, to let you know I had a retro segment planned. And I think I mistyped space. Because I fat finger texts all the time. And yeah, you responded and say, yeah, at least it's better than that. Great Stone Space Feces. So yeah, good stuff. Now, very quickly before we dive into the plot here, Voltron Defender of the Universe did have some silly episode titles, but those titles were never shown in the episodes. We never see a title overlaid in the episode as you watch it. So it really wasn't, as a longtime fan, those titles didn't become obvious until the DVD era when the titles were listed in the DVD box sets. And then, of course, they were on Netflix and everywhere else you see them online today. The episodes are out there for everyone to see. But back in the 80s, the show just had its intro segment and launched into the episode, and we didn't know what the show was called. We just enjoyed it. So uphill both ways in the snow, and we loved it. So yeah, let's go back to this vehicle team episode. And so this is an episode where the Stellar Ship Explorer, that's the ship that the vehicle team and other crew people are on, they land on a planet called Neb. And they notice that the planet's surface seems to be sinking. One of the continents is submerged. And so you have the air team and the sea team and the land team doing their various things. The air team is flying around the planet, checking it out from above. The sea team is underwater. The land team's driving on the surface. And they find the remains of a highly advanced city that has sunk underwater. And that's what the sea team finds. And the land team finds these giant Great Stone Space Faces. They look like the heads of the Easter Island statues that we all know about. And so what's really interesting here is that this planet has suffered a natural disaster at some point in the past, maybe years, maybe centuries ago. But the people, they have this advanced city, they have a spaceport in among the remains of the city. And then they have juxtaposed with that, they have these Easter Island sort of statues, these heads. What I loved about this episode is that it was neat to see a society after the fact. They had seemingly left the planet, but nobody knew for certain. And it's really cool to see the juxtaposition of advanced technology. I mean, it's not a city that looks like something we'd see here on Earth today, but one of those sci-fi kind of cities, like you might see on Alcarion or Earth in the Voltron time period, or Altea, a very advanced looking city. And it's submerged underwater because of a natural disaster. And it's clear that if any of the people survived, they could have left very easily in spaceships. And so juxtaposed with that are these very ancient statues. And there's a discussion where they talk about maybe those statues were made, they all face the sea, so maybe they had been made with some kind of religious significance to sort of appease the sea gods. And it's really neat to see that juxtaposition of religion and superstition with advanced science. And so they, you know, eventually they of course fight a row beast and all the rest of that kind of stuff. But I really enjoyed seeing this, the remnants, the remains of a very advanced and yet very, at the same time, arguably primitive society. It's just kind of a neat world building sort of thing. And it came to mind. I happened to really like the episode, and that's why it came to mind.
You're talking about Dead Planets, right? So Dead Planet from Vehicle Voltron episode, Dead Planet from Olkarion.
Yeah, and Olkarion, one of the things that I loved about the Olkari is that they had the connection to nature as well as technology and engineering. And the people of this planet, of Neb, had a sort of juxtaposition of their ancient ways of thinking and their advanced science. So there is a connection, maybe a tenuous one, but a connection between the people of Neb and the Olkari, which is kind of fun. Another thing that's cool is that as they're exploring the spaceport, part of the spaceport is submerged with the city, but part of it is above the water. Lisa of the sea team walks around and she sees a plaque that looks like a flag or some kind of an emblem that might have been associated with the people of Neb. And I didn't mention, but the planet has this very large, bright red moon. And we see a couple of nights during this episode, and the moon is just huge in the sky. And it's fun that the flag that she finds is a very large red moon in the center with this alien writing all around. And it's not that common in Voltron Defender of the Universe to see alien text. Usually you see no text at all, or you'll see English words and they've been often misspelled because they were drawn by people who speak Japanese as their first language. So to see actual alien text is really kind of cool in that show. But it's a fun one, and check it out.
And the old gives way to the new.
Yes, it does.
So you have Voltron Defender of the Universe giving way to Voltron Legendary Defender.
Yep, that's right.
So thank you for that retro Voltron segment.
All right, you're welcome.
All right, so that's going to do it for us for this week.
Yeah, it's been fun. Again, great Legendary Defender episode. It's been a lot of fun chatting about it with you.
And we will be going right on to our next episode review in the next podcast. So we're talking about episode five.
The Grudge.
The Grudge.
That's right. So that's a fun one as well. Very intense action. And we get reacquainted with a couple of our old friends from a prior season.
Yep, that's right. So we're looking forward to doing that next week, and we'll see you all next time on
Let's Voltron!